Welcome to Revolutionize Your Retirement Radio, bringing you insights and strategies to help you create a magnificent and fulfilling second half of life. Here's your host, certified professional retirement coach and best-selling author, Dr. Dorian Mincer.
I want to welcome everybody to the Revolutionize Your Retirement Interview with Expert series. I'm Dorian Mincer, the president and owner of Revolutionize Retirement. I'm delighted you're all with us today. Without further ado, let me introduce you to our wonderful guest, Elizabeth Fideler, or the name she generally goes by is Liz. Liz has her doctorate in education, and she's a research fellow at the Sloan Center on Aging and Work at Boston College. After several years of classroom teaching in Framingham, Massachusetts public schools, she earned a doctorate in administration, planning, and social policy from Harvard University. She continued working for many years as an education researcher and senior manager in nonprofit organizations. Her current research and writing interests focus on older women and men who choose to continue in the paid workforce beyond the conventional retirement age. And I already mentioned the names of the book, but let me mention them again. It's Women Still at Work, Professionals Over 60 and on the Job, and Men Still at Work, Professionals Over 60 and on the Job. She currently chairs the Framingham Public Library's Board of Trustees, as well as the library's biannual One Book, One Community initiative, Framingham Reads Together. She and her husband reside in Framingham, Massachusetts, and they have two adult children and five grandchildren. She's an experienced presenter and author of numerous articles and reports, and her blog appears in the agenda of the Sloan Center on Aging and Work. I had met Liz, I had known about her books, and then I met her locally because I also live in Boston, and she's become a member of the Life Planning Network and the Encore movement in Boston. And I have to say, I really encourage you to read her books. The stories in them are just fabulous. They're just wonderful stories. During the course of the talk, I know we'll hear about some of the women and men that Liz has interviewed for her work. Liz, maybe we can start. How did you get interested in older workers staying on the job and researching this and writing about it? It's such an important area. Can we start with that?
I came to this area, I guess it's a different way of revolutionizing retirement, because I think the categories used to be much more, the boundaries used to be much clearer, and people used to say, I'm working and then I'm retired, and that was it. And then people like you and other people in the Life Planning Network have been trying to help people deal with the remaining years, the second half, the second adulthood, the third chapter, and so on. I got into it because I had been doing education research, and my last full-time job came to an end when my federal grant ended. And I had not planned to retire. I didn't want to retire, and it was the beginning of the recession, and 2007, 2008, 2009, it was a tough time for everyone, and it was a very tough time to get another job. And I found that I was a finalist for some of the jobs that I applied for, research jobs, and that I realized that the people who were doing the hiring could hire someone half my age and half my salary. And I did some consulting, but since it was the recession, the consulting wasn't very lucrative, shall we say. And I began to wonder, what were other women my age doing? Were they staying at work? Were they staying on the job? Were they retiring? What were people doing about the big retirement decision? Because I was really struggling with the whole thing. I didn't want to say I was retired. I would sometimes say I was semi-retired. That led to my creating a survey and sending it to everyone I knew, and it snowballed, and it became a snowball sample. And I actually identified women all over the country and even out of the country, 155 or so women who were all working either full-time or part-time and were between the ages of 60 and 84. Mm. And that's how I got into it. And, of course, I had to do in-depth interviews. I chose about 33, 34 of those women to interview, which was the not just fun, but most gave me great satisfaction because I really felt I got to know some of these people. And they loved being interviewed because for a lot of older women, there wasn't much recognition. And these were very well-educated and highly accomplished women. And they were happy to be able to tell me what they had accomplished and what they were still accomplishing and why they were staying on the job. My real focus was finding out their discovering their reasons for continuing to work. And in the context of this recession that we were going through, everyone would say, of course, it's just the economy. But it was far more than that.
That became clear in the stories. It really is interesting. And in terms of the men, was it around the same time frame that you were beginning the work, learning about men also? I just want to include that because there are men and women on the call. So
definitely. The book on women came first, and that was published in 2012. And immediately upon publication and the book party that my family gave for the Women Still at Work book, a lot of the guests were included men in their 70s and older 70s, and they said, I'm still working. What about me? And what about men like me? And what about us? And I had been thinking of doing a book on men to see if there were any similarities or differences in the reasons and in the different things that the different fields that men and women were working in and so on. And that was all the encouragement I needed. So I then did a similar survey, of course, changed a few of the things to make it relevant to men. And again, it was uncanny. I got, again, 155, 156 surveys back from men all over the country and some men outside of the country, some from Canada, Belgium, men who were, as it turned out, just as happy to talk about how well-educated they were and what they were able to accomplish. I thought the men might be less talkative, but that was not the case. They were just as happy to be recognized. So I did in-depth interviews with, again, 34 of the men, and that resulted in Men Still at Work, and that just came out this year in February of 2014. It's two companion books, and the advantage of doing the second book was it allowed me to compare the genders.
Which we're going to get into, I hope, as we continue today, but again, I really do recommend the books. And just as I said earlier, if any of you came on late, you'll see on the event page that Liz has very graciously offered a 30% discount for each of the books for people who are listening in on the call. You might really want to take advantage of it. I recommend it. Tell us a little, what have you discovered about why older professionals want to remain in their careers longer than before? I mean, you did this during the recession, and as you commented before, part was the recession, part other things. So maybe you can elaborate on that?
Sure. First of all, contrary to expectations, just general opinions about why people would be working, of course there are people working out of necessity and people who have to work to make ends meet or they're supporting family members as well as themselves. People who are less well educated in low wage jobs, they typically don't have a choice about continuing to work. And I felt that Barbara Ehrenreich had done a very good job with Nickel and Dime in America to talk about people who are in the kinds of jobs that are not terribly satisfying for many and an awful mean that people have to work more than one job just to stay afloat. The cohort I tapped into in both the case of men and women were people in professional positions, many working for an employer, but quite a few also self-employed, people who were healthy and who wanted to keep working. So these are people who have had the choice, and the number one reason in both cases of men and women was job satisfaction. And, of course, they appreciate having the income from work. They may be also helping their adult children or their grandchildren financially with college tuition or something like that. But the essence of this it relates to job satisfaction. And that can mean different things to different people, of course.
Can you elaborate on that? Because it really can mean different things, yeah.
Sure. It can mean, for some people, it's all about using your abilities, your skills, your training, whatever you train for, whatever you prepared for, and putting all of that into play. And being in your 60s, 70s, or 80s, you're at the top of your game. You have very high levels of skill and experience. It could be enjoying your clients, your patients, if you're in medicine, your students, if you're teaching, your customers, if you're in business, just enjoying the people you work with. And if you really don't enjoy them, and if you don't like your boss and you don't like your colleagues, you probably would want to retire as soon as possible. But for people who feel that their colleagues are not necessarily part of their social life, but they're part of their lives, a very important part of their lives, as well as the clients, patients, and so on. For some people, job satisfaction means that they're making a difference. And this relates a lot to the movement, helping others and making a difference, making a contribution, having a purpose. There's a lot of ways of expressing it. But that was very important to a lot of people. So those are some of the meanings of job satisfaction. And then there were people who told me, who admitted that it was really all about staying alert, staying mentally alert, because they're actually afraid to retire. They're afraid to stop, not just for the loss of structure in their lives. They wouldn't know what to do when they woke up in the morning. It was more that they wouldn't know what to do with themselves, and because their brains would just turn to mush. Have you ever heard that kind of comment?
I have a lot, where people are really worried about that if you don't keep the neurons firing, that somehow there's going to be cognitive decline. And I think you speak to that a little bit in the book, too. That came up over and over again. Did you find a difference gender-wise between people worrying about that?
No, I didn't find gender differences with respect to that. I have been, I'm an avid crossword puzzle solver myself, mm-hmm. and I was actually a little distressed to find out that's not going to do it. That's not enough.
Can you say more about that?
I don't think it hurts in any way, and I get a lot of pleasure out of solving crossword puzzles, and it appeals to me. I don't know, it's maybe a little different way of thinking, that you make associations, whatever, and it certainly can't hurt your memory. But the research seems to say that solving puzzles isn't enough to keep your brain in good shape. I don't want to believe that, but I have to.
Yeah, right. No, I think it's true. But I think the staying connected, the staying engaged, the working, the number of the stories were really focusing on just feeling like it's a way to stay sharp. That seems so important. Did you find a different? Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say another angle on this, and among the reasons for staying on the job, is the wish, the goal of giving something back to the field one has contributed so much to already. And by mentoring young careerists, early careerists, the people who are going to eventually take one's place, that's a way of giving back. It's also a way of sharing one's experience and helping to keep the standards up in whatever the profession is. So that was another aspect of that was giving job satisfaction to some of the people, men and women.
Mm-hmm. That's really helpful to hear. What about the issue of financial security? I hear a lot that women, particularly older women, are less financially secure than older men. Do you find that?
And yes, I found evidence of that. Yes, in my research, I definitely saw that women are less secure financially than the men, because they receive less from Social Security, and that's explained. I'm sure many of the people on the call are familiar with this, so I don't want to preach to the choir, but many more of the men were working full-time and, more importantly, in higher-paying fields. So the professions that the men were engaged in were simply higher-paying fields. If they were in the STEM fields, for example, that women haven't been in as great numbers as men, So should I explain what STEM is, or does everybody know about
yeah.
that? Yeah. Okay.
Well,
science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. The men also, at least in my research, had worked for more years overall, because women typically had taken some time out for child rearing, or they might have been caring or are still now caring for an adult family member. And we have to remember, when these seniors came of age, it was the 1950s, the 1960s, 1970s for the younger ones. At that time, again, things were more black and white. Young men were expected to go to work and provide for a family and become the head of the household, and the young woman was expected to keep the house and produce the family. And I think young people are looking at that very differently today. I think there are not as many young people anxious to get married or to start families, for that matter, or they'll start a family without being married. There's a lot, things are looser and, shall we just say, more flexible socially. And the people I was studying pretty much conformed to expectations, at least when they were getting started.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, for example, there were women who told me, my father told me that I didn't need to go to college, my brother would go to college, and I didn't need to go to college, and I should just get married. Women were not encouraged to have careers. The fields that were open to them, again, these are the stereotypes. It was teaching and social work and nursing and being a secretary. That's not to say that there were no female physicians or lawyers, but certainly the largest number of women were in the helping professions. So a lot of women got started in the helping professions, but had other aspirations. Some of the women told me they put themselves through school, and maybe they married very young, maybe they started families, but they always wanted to do or be, have another career. And they worked very hard and they got there. So they'd be darned if they were going to stop now that they had finally reached the goal or the goals that they had set.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does get more complicated than that.
So the financial security, there's been a gender gap. Your question was really, what are the differences in terms of the finance-related differences? And there's been a gender gap. The gender pay gap has narrowed, happily, over recent years. But it's still there. And so that a lot of women, ultimately, when they're ready to take their Social Security, they're facing definitely a lower amount than a man in general would be getting. And that would be another reason to continue working. And this is in a lot of the literature today about personal finance, a lot of the boomers are admitting that they haven't saved enough for retirement, that they can't retire. And during the recession, a lot of people took, people who did have investments and did have savings, it really took a hit. For a lot of people, they became very nervous about whether they would have enough to retire ever. So when you see a lot of surveys of boomers, and people are saying, I'll never be able to retire.
Tied into what you were asking, one of the questions I did get was from Don, who was just wondering, from your research, is there anything in place for older workers similar to individuals with disabilities where there's some protection for them, or is that sort of not something that exists in our country?
We have had laws that are supposed to protect older, here means people 40 and up. And I think we could talk about what older means, because I think that's a very slippery concept. It means different things to different people. And the federal government talks about older, preventing age discrimination for 40-year-olds and up. We do have laws that say there's not supposed to be age discrimination in hiring and on the job. But that, I don't think that has been, I don't think we really know the extent to which age discrimination exists. Anecdotally, I think we hear that it's there, but it's very hard to prove in a lot of cases. Yes, there are laws on the books, but it's not clear how effective they are in protecting people.
Thanks for elaborating on that. What about the issue of self-employment versus working for people? Did you find much variation on that? And what it seems to me that I'm hearing that more and more people reach a point where they say, I don't want to work for anybody else anymore, and they want to become self-employed. Is that just an anecdote, or did you find that?
I've seen quite a bit of research that says that the number of older self-employed people is increasing, and entrepreneurship is definitely a growing trend. Of course, it takes resources to be a successful entrepreneur, so it's not for everyone. Not everyone has the means to start a business or to go into consulting. However, it offers a lot of advantages. Someone who may have been employed, had an employer, and who decides to go into business or consulting has great flexibility. It allows a person to work as many hours or as few as he or she wishes. So your schedule becomes your own, and it also allows you to work as much as you have the stamina to work. For someone who may be feeling, as the years creep on a bit, a little less energetic than in years past, it can be a very good solution. A person can work as much or as little as he or she wants, and it also leaves time for some of the other enriching activities, whether they're cultural, whether they're community-based, political, or spending time with grandchildren, or family, or spending time traveling. The things that people anticipate doing in retirement can be done when one works part-time, and self-employment allows a lot of freedom that way.
That's for sure. I know that from my own experience, too, that it gives you, sorry for that background, I'm just trying to get back on the internet here, that certainly is the case, that it allows for more freedom when you're doing it. But I want to get back to that point about who's older, because it somehow, just even when you were talking about self-employment, it seems you say that older is often considered 40 and up, and yet
that's in the age discrimination legislation,
right?
Says 40 and up. You don't see that in most other places.
What did you discover from your work in terms of people's perception of themselves as old or not old when they were 60, 70, 80? You even had some 90-year-olds.
I think census seems to be that the old, that would be in the 90s. And, of course, there are some exceptions. I found a woman named Olga, who was 95 or so, who's still running track and leaping hurdles. They're high jumping, doing all kinds of things. There are some truly exceptional people who have master's or senior level with athletic prowess. I think people think of the old or the really elderly as the 90s. And maybe the 70s, or for some even the 60s, are maybe the young olds. There's a lot of terminology thrown around. I really think it depends on your health,
mm-hmm.
and your attitude. And as you used the word earlier, engagement, how engaged you feel with not just on the job, but generally with your culture, your society, your family, your friends, your environment, your community. And there are a lot of very vital people doing all sorts of wonderful things. A lot of the people the men and women I wrote about in Women Still at Work and Men Still at Work are just very vital, and they're not denying that the years are passing by, but they're making the most of it.
Can you give an example of maybe one of the women?
One of the women.
Or one of the men.
Yeah, there are quite a few. One example of one man, I think this is a good example, was a very successful lawyer in private practice, making lots of money, who, as he got a little older, was very happy to be invited to teach law at the University of Washington. And he, of course, was taking a pay cut to do that, but he was still essentially in the same field, but able to, his whole, the pressures, the schedule, everything changed, and he found it very fulfilling. He finds it very fulfilling. Mm-hmm. So people can, some people want to change fields altogether. Some people merely want to be part-time in the very same job or field that they're in. I have had one woman who told me, you might say she liked to dabble. She was doing about five or six different things, making money from each in a small, in a modest way. But she and a few of the men I discovered were people who didn't want to do just one thing. They enjoyed bouncing around, you might say. Other people like to have one thing that they do, and they feel they've put in the years and they're reaping the rewards.
Mm-hmm.
One man had been a hospital administrator at a very high level and was very involved in the HMO field, health maintenance organizations, when that was a big thing. And now he's actually working for a health-related foundation, helping that foundation give their funds away to worthy organizations that are, again, this is all in the health field. So this man took his expertise and experience in the field and began using it in a different way that allowed him plenty of time to play the piano, which is his passion. Another man in his 80s, Michael Avsharian, is one of the founders of Shar Music. This is in Michigan. And Shar Music sells the strings and the bows for violinists and cellists and most of the string instruments, but other instruments as well. And he is, when I called to interview him, he was in the warehouse doing some work. And he is a highly accomplished violinist who has given violin lessons over the years to people who are now the next generation of instructors at Juilliard and places like that. And his favorite thing, even though he's totally invested in this business with his brother and his nephew, his favorite thing is giving violin lessons. That's his passion.
I love these stories. They're so great.
People are making it work for them, whether they continue full-time or they do something part-time, and then they often have work in some volunteer capacity in addition to working for pay. That was very heartening to find out how many people were also volunteering, people working full-time and doing something in the community.
I did find that amazing in your stories, too. It's that notion of ask busy people to do more things than they find the time than other people.
That's exactly it. Another trend seems to be, and you probably have come across this in your work, and people on the call will probably recognize this. There were people who told me that they had retired,
mm-hmm.
but they unretired, and that was a whole new concept. But it's happening because in many cases, people said to me, I just got bored, or I just needed the stimulation. I wanted to work, and when they jumped at the opportunity to go back to work. In some cases, it was for the money, but more again, the emphasis was not so much on the money as the stimulation and the excitement and the love of the work. I really want that to come across. These are people who really enjoy what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Absent that, it would be hard to continue and push themselves. If it was such a struggle, these people would be in a position to choose to retire and not work, and yet they're not making that choice. The unretiring I found very interesting.
Yeah, Tom, can you elaborate more on that? It's just that notion of it's both unretiring, but it's like, When do you think work becomes more of a calling or a cause for somebody? And yes, it's the financial, but you're saying it's that purpose and all. What did you learn about that? Because it feels like some of these people who continue into their 70s, 80s, and 90s, when they could retire, that there's something more at work with that.
I think the first thing that comes to mind is the field of science and medicine, the two fields of that. Those are big, broad fields, science and medicine. I think people for whom work is a calling or a cause, many of them are in, broadly speaking, helping professions, and there's always that drive to, maybe next year we'll have a cure for that disease. Maybe we can do more to help these people who are suffering with whatever. I think it helps a lot to have a sense of calling or cause, and it can be almost in any field. Maybe less so in business than these other helping professions. I'm, as you mentioned in the introduction, I'm, as a volunteer, I'm a library trustee in my community, in our library system, actually the chair of the library board of trustees. And it's a board of 12 trustees, all of whom are volunteering. And I'd have to say that supporting public libraries has become a calling or a cause. Mm-hmm. So it can be that you're a volunteer. You don't have to be earning money to have it be a calling or a cause, certainly. And I think many of the Encore career people are doing volunteer work. I'm not choosing sides here, but I happen to have focused more on the people who were still working for pay.
And I think also the Encore movement is shifting a bit, too, because people are recognizing with the way the economy is that many people really, that's the necessity part that you mentioned earlier, that people really need to keep working. So the Encore movement is really saying purpose, passion, and a paycheck. So they're a movement.
When it started, it didn't include the paycheck, but it certainly, there was a wake-up call.
Yeah, reality sets in.
Yeah.
Some of the things that you mentioned that I thought were really helpful, too, to think about is you talked about the role of parents in supporting or not supporting both the men and the women in terms of their work. And I wondered if you could talk a little about the positive and negative effects of fathers, grandfathers, mothers, grandmothers, because some say they were positive, some negative, some then worked against it, and some women felt their mothers were not good role models. Can you expand on that a bit and how that seemed to impact the people that I've learned about?
Parents and grandparents are certainly the early influences, and as are teachers, of course. And parents, especially fathers and grandfathers, are often the role models for working hard, working long. And I had some of the men say, and I can speak about the women too, but some of the men say they didn't want to be like their fathers or grandfathers. They could have gone into and they were expected to go into a father's business, and they didn't want to. Actually, one fellow, Alan Shedlin, his work today is called Real Fathers, R-E-L, as in film, Real Fathers, and he has a nonprofit that uses film to help biological fathers who don't have custody of their children, often young men who are ordered by the courts to go through anger management programs and so on. These are young men who want to be connected to their children and more involved with their children, and they don't really know how. And that's been Alan's work for many years now. And he and his colleagues use film to help these young men learn and discuss about the positives and negatives about fathering, about parenting. And Alan had a hard time, you might say, defying his father, but he's actually taken up fathering, or daddying, as he calls it, as his career field. Now, there were women who told me that their mothers were negative role models because the mother didn't work outside the home and was clingy and dependent on the husband, or the father of this young woman, in a way that influenced the young woman not to want to emulate her mother, but to go in a very different direction, have a good education and have a career. So in those cases, mothers were negative role models that was a spur or a prod to higher accomplishments. I just read a book by Megan Marshall, just finished her book on Margaret Fuller, who was a very good example of a very young woman who was brilliant, ambitious, had a phenomenal education, thanks to her father, but wasn't allowed to go to college because women, in the 19th century, women didn't go to Harvard, only men went. And she was living in the Boston area, and her circle were the intellectuals who became the transcendentalists, the Ralph Waldo Emerson group. However, she was not able to do what they did, and she desperately wanted to have a career, and there was nothing for her. Those stories of women being excluded from a lot of the things that men enjoyed or were able to do or had to do in terms of work, that was all closed to women, and some very bold and brave women broke the mold and broke the stereotypes gradually. So there's a whole in the book, Women Still at Work, there are some women who spoke of their, as feminists, of their determination to succeed at whatever it was that they wanted to do, regardless of whether their mother or father thought that was a good idea, or whether society thought that was a good idea.
I was so impressed with that in the stories. It's really...
It really come true.
Yeah. I just want to apologize. I came early to this meeting so that I would have internet and all, and so I can already feel, because I know a lot of people who are on the call, and the wonderful questions you're probably trying to ask, and I can't integrate them in, and I am so sorry.
Oh, maybe
you can get to them.
Dori, I've got access to them if you want me to ask them. This is Donna.
That might be great.
I can ask the questions if you want me to do that.
I feel so much better with that. Yeah, why don't we integrate a few of those? Is that okay with you, Liz?
That is. Go ahead. That's
okay. And then I want to get to some of the other things that I want to cover, too, but that makes me feel much better. Thank you, Donna, for telling
me
that.
Okay. I just want to acknowledge Alan from Covington, Louisiana, and Elizabeth Craig from Minneapolis. They both checked in and say hello, so hello to you. Marjorie from Somerville, you wanted to hear more about the how, but if you can just write in a question box in reference to how, what, I'm not quite sure what you're talking about there, so we can come back to that. Allie in California asked, did you find people using volunteering in a new field to bridge to a new career?
Yeah, that's comparable to young people today coming out of college while they're still in college, getting internships. And yes, older people are doing that as a bridge to a new career or just simply a bridge to a new job. There are, unfortunately, with all the unemployment we know people have been suffering through, even though the unemployment rate has dropped to just below 6%, which is better than the 10% where it was during the recession, that all looks good. But a lot of those new jobs that are making the statistics look better are part-time or temp jobs. And there are a lot of young people out looking for work, and then it turns out that when older people weren't being laid off, but when older people did become unemployed for whatever reason, they had a really hard time getting back in to the labor market. The volunteer work can be an avenue, a pathway into a new field or simply a new position.
That leads me to ask another question, too, in terms of that, because it makes me think about how often, particularly for women in the age group that you've been studying, many women took time out for child rearing and so entered later or re-entered into the labor market later. And I wondered if you could speak a little to that, how that seems to impact people's sense of either not wanting to retire ever, because many women are at their prime when sometimes the stereotype again is that men would be winding down. So can you speak about that and how prevalent you found that in terms of your work?
I think that it ties into what is successful aging, and that, of course, can mean different things to different people. I think for a lot of women, as you just said, they are in the prime or the peak of their career, and possibly they even feel that they're in the prime or the peak of their lives, more generally speaking. And why stop when you're feeling great about yourself? And for a lot of the men, if they've been working, if they started working earlier and have worked for many more years, they may feel that justly that they deserve to stop, and they, if they can afford to stop, that can be just the right answer for many men. However, some men find that people say, "What do you do?" That's the favorite thing for people when they meet you to ask. And for men, I think, I'm generalizing here, but I think for men more than women, what they do becomes tied up with their identity. And so if you're no longer being an ex, whatever you were, then who are you? If you don't have something to replace that, that can be tough. I think for the women, their identity, again, these are women of the generations that came of age in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s. For the women, I don't think they have that same identity crisis as they get older, as much as some of the men. In terms of self-definition, a woman might be happy to be more available to help out with grandchildren or something like that. It may or may not be the first thing that a man thinks of as a replacement for the work that he did.
But it's interesting that traditionally, particularly during the 50s, 60s, the notion was at least that the man was the head of the household and his career came first. That's what you're talking about. But what was interesting in some of your stories is some of the men retired and the women became head of households and breadwinners. And
that's right.
I wonder if you could elaborate on that, because I found that really interesting. Well, and I'm seeing that among my clients too.
Sometimes the woman is on her second or third husband, and mm-hmm. he might be younger than she is and still mm-hmm. working, so she wants to keep working. But sometimes it's the same husband that she started with, and he's ready to retire and she's not. And obviously they have to work that out between them, but sometimes the woman then becomes the breadwinner, and sometimes the woman is earning, I think it's not discussed very often, but sometimes the woman is earning a higher pay than the man, and it makes sense for her to be the one to keep working. Then you have, during the recession, now the recession's certainly in the dismal past, but it's not that far away. And during the recession, a lot more men got laid off because men tended to be in fields where the jobs disappeared, in manufacturing, in construction, and in middle management. A lot of men lost their jobs and their wives managed to keep going. And I saw some research that was interesting. There were stories of women were willing to go back to school and retrain and get a job just to keep supporting the family. And then they were just devastated by being unemployed, and they got paralyzed, and they weren't willing to take the steps necessary to reinvent themselves. And women were more open to that. I just found those stories quite interesting.
I find that in some of my clients, too, and it really is interesting. It speaks a little to the resilience that mm-hmm. many more of the women seem to have, when maybe because there have been multiple aspects of identity where work hasn't been the only thing, and just a different kind of bounce back than men have. It is interesting to think of these gender differences. That's why it's so great that you have both of these books. What about, do men still, though, hold in general, I mean, not even thinking about the people in this sort of stage, but men tend to hold the majority of the top jobs in the U.S., and there still is that sort of scarcity of women in top jobs. And do you have a sense of that? Is it just scarcity of positions, or is it still the kind of stereotypes about women and men more able, or what do you think is influencing that?
I think it's a combination of things, and I'm really hoping that some of the people who are listening in on the call will weigh in on this subject when we talk next week. I think it's, as I say, it's a combination. First of all, women have tended in, again, the women of who came of age in the 50s, 60s, 70s, they tended to stay away from a lot of the fields, what we call the STEM fields, for example, that were more lucrative. So they didn't get the education, the training that would have allowed them to be scientists of one kind or another, or in tech or fields that required what we call now high tech. So those were choices women made. Were those choices freely made? What were the influences? What were the social pressures or expectations that affected women, girls, as they went through school? And did girls really prefer to be librarians rather than scientists? I don't know if we take that on a case-by-case basis. Did women really prefer to be nurses rather than doctors? What was it? What was society saying to young women in terms of the education and training that they sought that then closed certain fields to them? At the same time, certainly in a lot of the business in the broadest sense, all across all the spectrum of different types of businesses, women were not what was Catherine Graham was the head of the Washington Post. And you can come up with some other wonderful examples of women in the top jobs. But those were exceptions, big exceptions.
Yeah. No, and I think I have an anecdote of my own experience. When I was 13, I loved science, and my science teacher took me aside after a presentation, and he said, "Don't be smart. Don't be smart. You're not going to get a husband."
Yes. And that was the advice. Yes. That was the myth, or the advice. Mothers and grandmothers would have probably were saying that to their daughters and granddaughters. It wasn't just men saying it. And when I was coming along in high school, my guidance counselor said to me that I didn't need any more math because I wasn't going to. She told me, "You're not going to be an engineer, or you're not going to be a this or that, so you don't need any of the what we would think of as college-ready math, college preparation math." So I didn't take it. Then, years later, when I was thinking of applying to business school, I thought, geez, how am I going to take the GREs, graduate record exam? I knew I would do fine on the verbal side because I had put so much emphasis on that. And I thought, so I went to the local state college and took college math. And I sat in the front row with one or two other women who were doing what I was doing. And we were, if the instructor assigned all the odd-numbered problems or whatever, we did all the problems because we were the real go-getters. And the young students were all, we were all mothers and older, obviously. And we were hard chargers. And the kids, as we called them, sat in the back of the class and kibitzed and whatever. And they got by. What we had goals, and we were the three stars in the college math class. And I had to do that because I'd never done it in high school.
Right.
I got some bad advice.
Yeah. That's so interesting, because maybe there's some other examples too, but I would imagine just yours and my situation are some of the differences of this kind of stories that women would have from men about what messages they got growing up that impact the work that they ended up going to. It's amazing. Do you have some other, I just think the work-life stories probably have such great gender differences for the most part.
Yeah, and one of the other divides today, of course, is technological literacy. And for seniors or older, wherever you want to peg them as older, there's the fear that if the computer is acting up, that I must have done something wrong. That there's hesitation on the part of a lot of older folks to, again, it's another stereotype. But then I talk to so many people today who they're texting and they're using their smartphones and they're doing everything because that's the only way they can communicate with their grandchildren is if they text. And so I think some of those technological barriers are breaking down. But it does affect what one can do on the job if you don't have some of the sharpest skills, the latest technologies, because they change so quickly, you can get left behind. And so that's an issue for men and women, and I think that we shouldn't count people out. We shouldn't make an assumption just because someone's in his 70s or 80s that he doesn't have the smarts.
That ties into that whole stereotyping question. You talk a lot in your books about this notion, all these pejorative notions directed at older men and women, such as you're over the hill or put them out to pasture. Or do you find that still continuing?
I think people know better than to use that language as much as we used to hear it, but I think it's still there. I think it's like an undercurrent. And in fact, somebody, a stranger, a woman, wrote to me just this past week that she had been essentially put out to pasture. She had lost her job, and she must have been doing internet searches or whatever, and she came across my books. And she found Women Still at Work, and she wrote a really feisty, I'm sure she's going to land on her feet, because I think she sounded like she was a really feisty person who just wasn't going to take no for an answer, and she was going to keep looking until she found something. But it takes that kind of gumption.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Not because the federal government, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, actually uses the word, the technical word is discouraged for people who are the long-term unemployed, who have been more than 27 weeks of unemployment. And they actually are called discouraged, and for good reason.
Yeah, for very good reason. I mean,
and companies say, unapologetically, that they don't want to hire someone who's been out of work for maybe a year, two, or more, because then they've gotten rusty. That's the assumption, is that their skills have gotten rusty, or they just will have lost their moxie. And so it makes it doubly hard for someone who is long-term unemployed to get back into the labor market.
So your example really about even you taking those math classes, or the women kind of somehow being more resilient than men, seems so important for people to hear that it is easy to get discouraged. All of us could, but it's a matter of trying to figure out then what are the skills, that gap analysis, what are the skills you need to hone up on so that you can become marketable again.
But also heightens it makes the men and women I did identify in my research, and I did write about and describe in the profiles and the books, they really stand out against this background of an economy that's not fully recovered and is not serving everyone as well as we'd like. These people are managing to continue achieving, and one might say how fortunate they are, and they know they're fortunate to be prospering at a time when a lot of people are not.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt that their stories deserved telling. In fact, some of the women told me, and I think I mentioned it earlier, how there's also a little bit of a double standard, I think, in terms of women's appearance as they get older. Older women can be overlooked and not recognized, so to speak, whereas older men can be looking handsome or distinguished. It can be an advantage to be an older man with gray or white hair. It's not always such an advantage for a woman. And the women definitely were sensitive to the over the hill or out to pasture kind of remarks. And they didn't want to start dressing like teeny boppers in order to look. That wouldn't have been an answer or appropriate. Some of the women did admit to doing what they could at the hair salon to keep their hair looking younger. Men don't seem to have to worry so much about their attire, their hairstyle, or whatever, to fit in with younger people or to look younger. Men seem to have it easier that way. Women sometimes feel that they're not recognized in as favorable way as men, so that their story can differ from a man's story of the man of the same age.
Which is, I think, you really do highlight that so nicely in the books. And But it really is true that there is something in our society where men can maintain their place more than women, and it's hard. So what do you have suggestions? The other reality is that men and women, but I think it's harder for women to be in situations, or potentially harder for women to be in situations where they're younger colleagues, or it could be. And yet the women in your, that you highlighted, negotiated that so well. And maybe you could speak a little of what are some of the things that might help so that there's
One thing I might mention, one of the co-presenters that with whom I'm working for the Aging in America conference, that's in Chicago in March.
Right.
One of the young women from the Netherlands is Anna-Marie Boekens. And the fellow who's co-presenting with us is from New Zealand, and his name is Jeff Pearman. And Jeff is working on what we might say the corporate side of the HR side of this dilemma. Lots of the people probably on this call, and you yourself, your clients, the people you who come to you to talk about retirement issues and whatever, tend to be the individuals who may or may not be having some difficulties or concerns about the retirement decision or their how it's playing out. Jeff is working on the corporate side to get companies to see the older workers, and again, this whole aging phenomenon is happening all over the world. So he's working with New Zealand and Australian companies to help them to understand the importance of diversity, demographic diversity in the workplace in terms of age, so that younger people need to know what it is that they should be appreciating about the older colleagues on their team or in their work setting.
Yeah.
And older people need to understand where the young people are coming from. And to be a good team across mixed ages, and that's what we're talking about now, is that takes some training and some appreciation of putting yourself in the other person's shoes to get the most, to maximize the pluses of having older, experienced people as well as young and very energetic and bright and recently trained people. People need sometimes to be helped to see what's in their best interest as far as the productivity in the workplace, whatever the field happens to be.
Great. I know we're over time, and you had said you'd be willing to stay a little, and because of the computer problems, I took advantage of that. But Donna, are there any sort of pressing questions that look like from people who submitted them that maybe we could just integrate quickly?
Marjorie wrote back from Somerville and said, what were the processes and hurdles, emotional or otherwise, to making these changes? And I'm assuming she's talking about going from retired to unretired or changing jobs and retirement or maybe going from volunteering back to working.
A quick answer to that would be, I think it depends on how much support one has, if one has a partner or spouse. I think it helps to have someone who's supportive of what you're aiming to do. And I do have some men and women in both of the books. There were people I interviewed and profiled. Some had never married, and some were widows or widowers. So not everyone has a live-in partner. It can be a close friend. It can be a family member. Everyone needs some support. It could be a retirement coach, but everyone needs someone to bounce the ideas off of and to get affirmation that what you're doing is not nuts and that it can work. And I think that the support in terms of the emotional support that Marjorie from Somerville is talking about, it's important to have friends, family, close people who can help you with that.
And just to put a plug in for Liz's books, the stories highlight some of that and give you some examples of the important people that were part of some of the people that she highlights, some of their life and how important that was to be able to deal with the hurdles. Because for everybody, there are, tend to be hurdles at one time or another.
Yeah, many of the people said, when I asked them if you had a mentor, a lot of the people were saying that they were mentoring younger people, but that they also told me that they themselves had been mentored by maybe a professor or a teacher or a dean. The opposite of what your science teacher told you, Dori, someone who patted you on the shoulder and said, I guess people can't pat girls on the shoulder anymore. Okay. Someone who at least gave you a metaphorical pat and said, you're going to be a great scientist someday. That would have been sent a whole different message to you.
Totally.
Right? Yeah. So someone who affirms how hard you're working and how you might succeed in whatever it is. And it can be a boss in your first job. It could be lots of people. And there was a whole range of people. I had people who told me Nancy Drew was my role model because she was such an intrepid girl detective. That funkiness. You can see how appealing that would be, and I'm sure some of the people on the call are probably old enough to have read Nancy Drew.
I think many of us.
Yes.
But not all. Yeah, the mentoring part really is so important, both having been mentored, but even if you haven't been, the role of both women and men mentoring younger people, and particularly I think it comes out of, and I hear this a lot, of just women mentoring other women, because there really are these gender differences that have been there, at least in our generation. Maybe it's going to be different for the younger kids who came along with the notion that there were possibilities for everybody, but certainly not in our generation. It's not been that way.
I think I don't want to give the impression, Dori, that these stories in these two books are just for people who happen to be 70 or 80 or 60 now.
Right.
I think it's valuable for someone who's in his or her 40s, 50s now, someone who's going to be looking ahead to that whole question about will I retire, will I be able to retire, what's that all going to look like. This can be valuable for people who are thinking ahead.
Oh, absolutely.
These books and these stories can tell them a lot about what it might look like for them.
Absolutely, because I think what you highlight is some of what we've been talking a bit about today, too. It's the notions, and for people who are at the earlier parts of getting older, it's like, what is successful aging? What are my options? How do I want to have this sense of fulfillment? And I think what's happening more and more is it's the whole concept of retirement changing. Many people in their 40s and 50s perhaps will begin to envision that it makes sense, and they want to continue to work until, I always love Jan Hively, who I just had breakfast with this morning at this meeting. She always says, working paid or unpaid through your final breath. She clarified this morning it was through your final breath, not even before your final breath. Like that was your final breath that you did a piece of work or something. So I think absolutely, I think the book and your research is good for us who are older, but it's really good for the younger people coming along. Absolutely. Any other kind of, that seems like a pressing question, Donna? Otherwise, I want Liz to just give a takeaway comment. But any other?
No, that's about it.
Okay, great. Well, this was fabulous. I so appreciate it. Any final just takeaway that you'd like to leave people with as we end?
The takeaway would be with people living longer and one hopes healthier than ever, if you can keep working and you want to keep working, go for it, because it's all about job satisfaction. And of course, every individual makes the decision that's best for him or her. But in general, I would just encourage anyone who's contemplating staying on the job to do.
Great. That's a very good takeaway. And I want to thank you so much.
Thank you, Dori. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it very much.
Thank you again, Liz, and take care.
You've been listening to Revolutionize Your Retirement Radio with Dr. Dorian Mincer. To learn more about the resources mentioned on today's show, listen to past episodes, or download our free retirement transition guide, visit revolutionizeyourretirementradio.com.